Okay, I should make sure that everyone had a chance to sign the roll book. Bill needs it again. Okay. Someone gave me this issue of National Geographic that has pictures pertaining to the life of Martin Luther. I'll go ahead and pass this around while I'm lecturing on the 2300 Days of Daniel. You can look at it. Some of them are really interesting. I have this issue at home, and I'd forgotten that I had. I think you'll enjoy looking at these pictures. Starts on page 418. Okay, we're talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. He and Luther both had a mean streak. I suppose we could draw a commonality there. Luther really did have a mean streak in him. You take my church history class, I'll read you some of the quotations of things that he said. Boy, they burn your ears. Okay, now let's see. We're talking about many of the people, those who abandoned the law, joined them and committed evil in the land. Israel was driven into hiding wherever places of refuge could be found. On the 15th day of the month Chislu, in the year 145, see, is that the same year? No, 145. That'd be two less, 165. Is that right? 145? What do you get for that? Maybe that's still 167. 312 minus 145. I'm too tired to do the math in my head. Is it 167? Okay. So he says, on the 15th day of the month Chislu, that's Chisleu, the king erected the horrible abomination upon the altar of holocausts. And in the surrounding cities of Judah, they built pagan altars. They also burnt incense at the doors of houses and in the streets. Now, the burning of incense was regarded as religious worship to their gods. So this would mean they did this right at the door of every home to make the inhabitants participate in false worship. Any scrolls of the law which they found, they tore up and burned. Can you see that happening in the future? Whoever was found with a scroll of the covenant and whoever observed the law was condemned to death by royal decree. So this means you couldn't even own a copy of the Bible. If you were even found in possession of a copy of the Bible, you would be killed. And notice that it also says, and whoever observed the law was condemned to death by royal decree. So that means not just if you have a Bible, but if you follow the Bible. If you keep the laws, you're still put to death, even if you don't own one. Whoever was found with a scroll, let's see, so they used their power against Israel and against those who were caught each month in the cities. On the 25th day of each month, they sacrificed on the altar erected over the altar of holocausts. Now that's because Antiochus Epiphanes was born December 25th, surprisingly enough. And so on the 25th of every month, they had a special birthday celebration for the king. Now what this is saying is they built an altar like this over the top of God's sacrifice altar. Okay, I didn't draw that very well, but you know what I'm saying. They built this other bigger altar over the top of God's altar. And on the 25th of every month, they offered heathen sacrifices on it. Women who had their children circumcised were put to death in keeping with the decree with the babies hung from their necks. Their families also, who had them circumcised, were killed. But many in Israel were determined and resolved in their hearts not to eat anything unclean. They preferred to die rather than to be defiled with unclean food or to profane the Holy Covenant, and they did die. Terrible affliction was upon Israel. So they preferred to die rather than eat any unclean food at all. Now, there are a lot of Christians in our church that have that feeling. They'd never eat anything unclean ever for any reason. And I believe in not eating unclean meats too. I'm not sure right now with my own conscience whether I would go that far with the thing. I kind of figure this in a certain way, that before I got saved, for 18 years I ate a lot of unclean meat and I didn't die. If it's a health law, you know, God says don't eat it, so you don't eat it. But I could foresee myself being in a situation maybe where that was a religious test to them maybe, and they would say, here, eat this piece of pepperoni or we'll kill you, you know. Well, I'm not sure there's all that much in that little stick of pepperoni that would really kill me. I might do it, I don't know. That's my own conviction. Pastor says his dad would die before he would eat a piece of pork, for sure. He knows that. And maybe I'm weak on this law, but since it's not really a religious law, like baptism or affirming the deity of Christ or something like that, then I guess I don't feel quite that strongly about it that I would die, but that's a personal matter with me. I don't eat unclean meat. In those days, Mattathias, son of John, son of Simeon, a priest of the family of Jeriah, left Jerusalem and settled in Modin. Now we're going to talk about this Maccabean family. That's M-O-D-E-I-N. It's a city in Israel. And so the father's name is Mattathias. That's M-A-T-T-A-T-H-I-A-S. And we're going to see that he has five sons. So we're going to read their names here and write them down. This is the family of the Maccabees. Chapter 2, Mattathias and his sons. In those days, Mattathias left Jerusalem and settled in Modin. He had five sons, John, Simon, Judas, Eleazar, and Jonathan. To read the list again myself. John, Simon, Judas, Eleazar, and Jonathan. Eleazar is E-L-E-A-Z-A-R. When he saw the sacrileges that were being committed in Judah and in Jerusalem, he said, "Woe is me! Why was I born to see the ruin of my people and the ruin of the holy city, and to sit idle while it is given into the hands of enemies, and the sanctuary into the hands of strangers?" And then it gives a poem again. "Her temple has become like a man disgraced. Her glorious ornaments have been carried off as spoils. Her infants have been murdered in her streets, her young men by the sword of the enemy. What nation has not taken its share of her realm and laid its hand on her possessions? All her adornment has been taken away. From being free, she has become a slave. We see our sanctuary and our beauty and our glory laid waste, and the Gentiles have defiled them. Why are we still alive?" Then Mattathias and his sons tore their garments and put on sackcloth and mourned bitterly. The officers of the king, in charge of enforcing the apostasy, came to the city of Modin to organize the sacrifices. Now, they're coming to your town. You ready? Many of Israel joined them. This is that same sad story. A whole bunch of Christians, many, it says, joined right over with their forces. But Mattathias and his sons gathered in a group apart. Boy, we can even learn from that. That would be the right thing to do. You know, if we had happened to us, that little scenario I said when these army men all drive up in trucks and they jump out, and you see that happening, you know what the Christians should do? They should all run right out the back door, through the backyard, over the fence, and all gather together in a group. That's what they should do. They should get away if they can and gather together in a group. You know what would happen at Community Chapel if America, if a war started and America was at war instantly Maybe they bombed the west coast of America or something. You know what would happen? They would all go right to church. All the true Christians who really love God, you'd meet them right at church. That's exactly what would happen. That's where I'd go. I see Steve nodding his head. That's where he would go. What? It's the truth. If something like that happened, you'd figure God's leaders will know what to do, and you know the pastor will know what to do, and then you just go, and God will lead us. We need to pray, that's for sure. Ask the Lord to help us. Pray for protection. Get the mind of God. It's the safest thing to do. And that's what Eliezer did. Mattathias did, and his sons. They gathered in a group apart. That way they can always talk over what's happening. They're standing in a group apart, and they can say, see what that guy's doing? That's wrong. We shouldn't do that. And we all agree that God's mind is to do thus and so. And you get strength when there's a group of you like that. Then the officers of the king addressed Mattathias. And guess why they're addressing Mattathias? Because he's the most famous guy among them. He's the leader of the best top religious men. So the officer of the king wanted to talk to him first. You are a leader, an honorable and great man in this city, supported by sons and kinsmen. Come now, be the first to obey the king's command, as all the Gentiles and the men of Judah and those who are left in Jerusalem have done. Now here you see the lying nature of these men. See, that's a lie. It's not true that all the Gentiles and the men of Judah and those who are left in Jerusalem did sacrifice. For sure, there were some people who didn't give in. But see, these type of men are willing to lie. They'll exaggerate the true story in order to get you to believe what they want you to believe. Everybody is sacrificing, so you need to sacrifice. Well, just know he's lying to you. If he told you the truth, he would say, everybody in that town, except 50 strong-willed Christians, they left and they were hidden by 50s in caves. That's the truth. But he doesn't tell you that. It makes you feel like, are you kidding? You mean everybody did? You mean Billy Graham did? You mean David Wilkerson did? Yeah, that's what he told you. No, they didn't. If the truth is known, the strongest Christians stood against it and they did not bow their knee to Baal. That would give you a little bit more impetus not to give in. But see, they lie to you. And then it says, then you and your son shall be numbered among the king's friends and shall be enriched with silver and gold and many gifts. Oh, you liar. Are you kidding? Would you really trust a guy like that? Would you trust a murderer of women and children, a cold-blooded murderer of innocent women and children who killed people with a sword? And then he says, go ahead, you sacrifice and you'll be among the king's friends and we'll give you riches and honor. I wouldn't trust that guy for 30 seconds. I mean that, seriously. I would not trust him for 30 seconds. Because if he promised you that and you sacrificed, 30 seconds after you sacrifice, he could take your head off. I'm serious. That's the kind of guys these are. They're slick. You learn that these demons are slick? Boy, I'm learning that. They are so clever. It's like the scripture of David and Saul in the Old Testament. You know what it says? It says, David was anointed by God, and Saul began to oppose him and throw spears at him. And in the next chapter it says, and David behaved himself more wisely. More wisely. Once his life was on the line, he behaved himself more wisely. And then in the next chapter they have another confrontation and more spears thrown at him. And the end of that chapter it says, and David behaved himself more wisely. More wisely than all the servants of Saul. So he became even more careful and more wise in his behavior, the harder the thing got. That's where you and I need to be. We need to be making sure that we're behaving even more wisely. Especially in a time of persecution like this. I would never trust one of those guys, ever. I am totally committed to the idea that under persecution, anything they tell me is likely to be a lie. Anything. That's what I believe. If it comes down to that, I'm going to pray and ask God what to do. And I'll do whatever He tells me to do. And if I don't know what to do, I'll simply take the action that seems to be the safest at the time. That's what it's my conviction right now. But Mattathias answered in a loud voice. I might just point out, ye shall be numbered among the king's friends. That's a bad place to be on the day of judgment. To be, you know, I'm one of Antiochus's good friends. But Mattathias answered in a loud voice, although all the Gentiles in the king's realm obey him so that each forsakes the religion of his fathers and consents to the king's orders, yet I and my sons and my kinsmen will keep to the covenant of our fathers. God forbid that we should forsake the law and the commandments. We will not obey the words of the king nor depart from our religion in the slightest degree. Boy, what a strong statement. Now, I'm not here to predict valiant behavior for myself, because I have learned that when people predict what valiant behavior they will have when they face a fearful situation, oftentimes they are wrong. And they say, if this ever happens, I'll behave thus and so. Well, you don't know till it really happens. You don't know. It isn't safe or wise to predict valiant behavior for yourself in the face of a fearful situation. I have not been confronted with lots and lots of fearful situations. I have been confronted with some. A number of violent ones, including ones that threaten my very life. It is true that in those cases, I didn't seem to have any fear at the time. So I can give you that personal testimony that it is possible. I wouldn't say that I'd predict that for me every time, depending upon what happens. Who knows? Nobody knows for sure. You just have to trust God. It becomes a matter of faith. This guy did. He stood right up to the militia and said, we will not obey the king's orders in the slightest degree. As he finished saying these words, a certain Jew came forward in the sight of all to offer sacrifice on the altar in Modin, according to the king's order. Now this guy's volunteering, I guess. I don't know. They're talking to Mattathias, and they said, Mattathias, you sacrifice first. And in effect, he says, no. And he looks over, and here's this Jew walking over to sacrifice. I don't know what he's volunteering for. He's scared, I guess. He wants to make sure that he gets his sacrifice in so they leave him alone and don't cut his head off. When Mattathias saw him, he was filled with zeal. His heart was moved and his just fury was aroused. He sprang forward and killed him upon the altar. So he killed his own Jewish brother. At the same time, he also killed the messenger of the king, who was forcing them to sacrifice, and he tore down the altar. Thus he showed his zeal for the law, just as Phinehas did with Zimri, son of Salu. Then Mattathias went through the city shouting, let everyone who is zealous for the law and who stands by the covenant follow me. Thereupon he fled to the mountains with his sons, leaving behind in the city all their possessions. Okay. Somebody make some application now to any part of that story that you think you might see in the future. I think it's true that under the Antichrist, you'll probably see groups of Christians flee out into the wilderness in this manner. I really think that's true. Leaving behind in the city all their possessions. And so that'll be a sad day for covetous Christians. Covetous Christians whose whole Christianity is based upon piling up more and more goods in this world, that'll be hard for them. The Laodicean who says, I am increased with goods. You know, if you're increased with goods, you're going to have a hard time leaving them all. I learned this lesson in 1986. I learned the lesson of joyfully taking the spoiling of my goods. Now, I didn't take it joyfully at first. I took it with a lot of turmoil inside. But I learned to joyfully take the spoiling of my goods. It's true. It's possible. In God, it is possible. I feel like today I could lose literally any possession that I own. I can't think of even one possession that I own, my Bible, anything, and it wouldn't bother me at all. I could give you illustrations of that to show my reactions, and my reactions were good. It took a while, but I got to where nothing mattered. It's true. It can happen. And then it says, many who sought to live according to righteousness and religious custom went out into the desert to settle there. Now there's one of the little keys, maybe you caught that one, that shows that this isn't really inspired from God, because it's commending those who lived according to righteousness and religious custom, as though religious custom were, you know, a necessary thing. And it says, went out into the desert to settle there, they and their sons, their wives, their cattle, because misfortunes pressed so hard on them. It was reported to the officers and soldiers of the king who were in the city of David in Jerusalem. Now notice, the city of David refers to this little citadel area within Jerusalem that was fortified. They kept their armaments there, and they used it as a base for their army men. It says, it was reported to the officers there in Jerusalem that certain men who had flouted the king's order had gone to hiding places in the desert. Boy, I can see that happening. The Christians all flee out to some location, and it'll be reported right back to the officers, and they'll say, these Christians, they fled out into the desert, and we know where they are. And so, of course, they'll go out to get them. And then it says, many hurried out after them, and having caught up with them, camped opposite and prepared to attack them on the Sabbath. Now, why are they going to attack them on the Sabbath? Holly? They won't fight back. See, these are the Jews who are committed to keeping the Bible. They're not going to give in. They're going to follow what God said in the Bible. And so because these are the ones that are going to follow the Bible, it's easy to attack them on the Sabbath because they're not going to fight back. That would be work. Somebody tell me your opinion of whether it's right or wrong to let yourself be slaughtered on the Sabbath. It's wrong. How many agree it's wrong? How many agree it's right? If God says, don't work, you don't work. You just sit there and let him kill you.
It's both right and wrong. It depends your motive and the situation and circumstances surrounding it. It's not so black and white.
Give me an example where it would be wrong then. Why it would be wrong.
Wrong to fight?
Yeah.
Well, like Paul says to the Corinthians in chapter 13, if you give your body to be burned, but you don't know love, nothing. So if your whole motive for fighting on the Sabbath is to do murder and vengeance, and you have powerful demons of revenge on the enemy, it's not really going to profit you any, and it's going to do the testimony of God harm.
So you would say it'd be better for that guy not to fight and just let himself be killed.
Right.
And give me the opposite case. What you think about that?
If you're surrounded, but on the other hand, if you have a good chance, if you believe God has given you the enemy in your hands, and you're like Jonathan and his armor bearer, and you hear from God, go up and take that city or that group, then by all means, go ahead and fight.
So are you saying it depends on the leading of God?
Yes.
But you are saying that it wouldn't be wrong to fight on the Sabbath. Yeah, see, that's the position these guys took. They took the position it was wrong to fight on the Sabbath. See, that just can't be true. The reason it can't be true is God's intent is violated.
Exactly.
The intent of God to give you the Sabbath is just to help your life. He has your best interest at heart. When he made the Sabbath law, he made it so that you could rest and have a good day on the Sabbath, right? He didn't make the law so you'd have a bad day. He made the law so you'd have a good day. Now, the ultimate bad day is to have the army come in and then you just sit there and let them kill you. You know. And so it violates the true meaning of the law. Okay, so here's the story. Hang on. Many hurried out after them, prepared to attack them on the Sabbath. Enough of this, the pursuers said unto them, come out and obey the king's command, and your lives will be spared. I still wouldn't trust them. If they said, come out of the cave and we'll spare your life, I still wouldn't trust them. I'd stay right in the cave. I'm never going to do what these guys tell me to do. I'm committed to that. But they replied, we will not come out, nor will we obey the king's command to profane the Sabbath. Then the enemy attacked them at once, but they did not retaliate. They neither threw stones nor blocked up the entrance to their hiding places. They said, let us all die without reproach. Heaven and earth are our witnesses that you destroy us unjustly. So the officers and the soldiers attacked them on their Sabbath, and they died with their wives, their children, and their cattle to the number of 1,000 persons. Boy, what a tragedy. 1,000 Jews died just because they didn't obey understand the Sabbath law. They were legalistic. They were legalistic on that law. When Mattathias and his friends heard of it, they mourned deeply for them. If we all do as our kinsmen have done, they said to one another, and do not fight against the Gentiles for our lives and our traditions, they will soon destroy us from the earth. On that day they came to this decision, let us fight against anyone who attacks us on the Sabbath, so that we may not all die as our kinsmen died in the hiding places. And so we say they learned a lesson from that, and that's good. Then they were joined by a group of Hasidians, valiant Israelites, all of them devout followers of the law. What lesson for future Christians do you think we can learn from that? It says they were joined by a group of devout Israelites. You know what that shows me? It shows me that the strongest Christians who will defy the persecution, they draw other strong Christians to them. That's what happens. And this is true in churches. Churches that take a strong stand for God and for the Word of God, churches that take a strong stand for worshiping Jesus Christ will draw those whose hearts are to worship Christ. Churches that take a strong stand on holiness standards in their church, they draw people in who take that stand. Churches who take a strong stand on personal relationships and love and friendships among church members, they draw that kind of person to their church. Churches that take a strong stand on prosperity and blessing draw that kind of people to their church. They just do. That's the way churches are. You know what the scripture teaches? It teaches, God shall give you the desires of your heart. Did you know that? God loves you so much, He'll give you the desires of your heart. Now that's good, and that's dangerous. It's good because if you really are seeking the Lord and you want holiness and God's purity and God's will to be done in your life, He'll give you the desire of your heart. On the other hand, if the desire of your heart is materialism, He'll probably give it to you. He probably will. He probably will. I've seen this come to pass in Christians' lives where God will give you the desire of your heart. In fact, it's that way in prayer too. I have prayed very specifically many, many hundreds of times. I find myself praying this way. I know what I want to pray for almost all the time, every day. I ask for the most specific things from the Lord. Probably you'd be shocked if you heard me pray sometimes. I know exactly what I want. And I know that I don't always ask for the right thing. But, you know, I always pray very specifically, because I really follow that scripture that says, acknowledge Him in all of your ways. I take that to mean in every area of my entire life. my home, my family, my automobile, my money, my everything. Places I go, things I do, people I meet, things I write, things I think about, people I'm going to talk to, I pray about all that kind of stuff. And I pray specifically. I pray, God, I'm going to meet with this person at 2 o'clock, and it seems to me that what they need to do is A, B, and C. And I don't want them to do D. And so if this is your will, cause A, B, and C to happen, and whatever you do, don't let D happen. And so I do. I pray like that all the time. And I have seen God answer me over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. It's remarkable. The testimony really is remarkable. If I could give you details that have happened in my life, you might be surprised. So, in a time of persecution, if the strongest believers unite together, it draws others to them. That's what we learn from this. They were joined by a group of Hasidians, valiant Israelites, all of them devout followers of the law. And all those who were fleeing from the disaster joined them and supported them. In other words, you might feel alone at first. You might say, boy, there's only six of us, and we're committed in God against this persecution, and we flee. How are we going to get along? There's only six of us. Just know, soon there's going to be 12 of you. Soon there's going to be 18 of you. God knows you strong six are there. God knows you're there. And God has another strong six in another city. And He could put it upon them. He'll make you run into one another some way. I believe this with all my heart. And I think in time of persecution, up here in the head, with whatever we go through, whatever cities we're in, just know this. You stand strong for God, and He'll send another one to strengthen you. I really believe that. They gathered an army and struck down sinners in their anger and lawbreakers in their wrath, and the survivors fled to the Gentiles for safety. Now, I'm not agreeing that's necessarily the right thing to do. What this means is this group of valiant Israelites who stood for the law began killing other Jews who were giving in. Their brethren. Mattathias and his friends went about and tore down the pagan altars. They also enforced circumcision for any uncircumcised boys whom they found in the territory of Israel. They put to flight the arrogant, and the work prospered in their hands. They saved the law from the hands of the Gentiles and the kings, and did not let the sinner triumph. When it came time for Mattathias to die, he said to his sons, "Arrogance and scorn have now grown strong. It is a time of disaster and violent anger. Therefore, my sons, be zealous for the law and give your lives for the covenant of your fathers. Remember the deeds that our fathers did in their times, and you shall win great glory and an everlasting name. Was not Abraham found faithful in trial, and it was reputed to him as righteousness?" Now, there's a false doctrine. It's not true that Abraham was found faithful and it was counted to him for righteousness. The scripture teaches Abraham believed God and it was accounted to him for righteousness. Joseph, when in distress, kept the commandment and he became master of Egypt. Phinehas, our father, for his burning zeal, received the covenant of an everlasting priesthood. Joshua, for executing his commission, became a judge in Israel. Caleb, for bearing witness before the assembly, received an inheritance in the land. David, for his piety, received as inheritance a throne of everlasting royalty. Elijah, for his burning zeal for the law, was taken up to heaven. Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, for their faith, were saved from the fire. Daniel, for his innocence, was delivered from the jaws of lions. And so consider this from generation to generation, that none who hope in him shall fail in strength. Do not fear the words of a sinful man. For his glory ends in corruption and worms. Today he is exalted, and tomorrow he is not to be found, before he has returned to his dust and his schemes have perished. Children, be courageous and strong in keeping the law, for by it you shall be glorified. It's another theological error. Here is your brother Simeon, whom I know is a wise man. Listen to him always, and he will be a father to you. And Judas Maccabeus, a warrior from his youth, shall be the leader of your army and direct the war against the nations. You shall also gather about you all who observe the law, and you shall avenge the wrongs of your people. Pay back the Gentiles what they deserve. There's another false doctrine. and observed the precepts of the law. Then he blessed them, and he was united with his fathers. He died in the year 146 and was buried in the tombs of his fathers in Modin, and Israel mourned him greatly. Okay, that was 1 Maccabees 1 and 2. Now we go to 2 Maccabees chapters 5 through 7. These are further details about Antiochus' persecution against the Jews. Chapter 5. About this time, Antiochus sent his second expedition into Egypt. It then happened that all over the city, for nearly 40 days, there appeared horsemen charging in midair, clad in garments interwoven with gold, companies fully armed with lances and drawn swords, squadrons of cavalry in battle array, charges and countercharges on this side and that, with brandished shields and bristling spears, flights of arrows and flashes of gold ornaments, together with armor of every sort. Now this is kind of flowery for Bible. It doesn't quite sound like the Bible to me. Did any of you notice that as I was reading, or did it seem okay to you? Seem kind of... See, I told you, 1 Maccabees is better than 2 Maccabees. And it starts out here in chapter 5 with that kind of a thing. This is less biblical than the other book. Oh, it's not a vision. It's just describing what literally happened in the city of Jerusalem. How their armies were parading up and down the streets, killing people and that kind of thing. It's a literal statement. And then it says, oh no, excuse me, I was totally wrong. I'd forgotten that it said this. You're right. It says, it happened then that all over the city for nearly 40 days there appeared horsemen charging in midair, etc., 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 etc. Verse 4, therefore all prayed that this vision might be a good omen. So, it was a vision. I'm not sure why it lasted 40 days. I don't know. That seems really unusual to me, too. Also seems unusual that they prayed it would be a good omen. Okay, verse 5. I told you, this book, 2 Maccabees, is not as good as 1 Maccabees. Okay. But when a false rumor circulated that Antiochus was dead, Jason gathered fully 1,000 men and suddenly attacked the city. As the defenders on the walls were forced back and the city was finally being taken, Menelaus took refuge in the citadel. Now this guy Menelaus, I haven't told you about him yet, he is a man, M-E-N-E-L-A-U-S, whom Antiochus Epiphanes appointed to be the high priest of Israel. He deposed the true high priest and stuck this Jewish traitor into that office. This guy is a puppet. He's not a real true minister of God. He's siding with Antiochus in everything against the Jews, and he's a figurehead high priest. So it says Menelaus took refuge in the citadel. So don't you know that in the city, these false religious leaders, these wolves in sheep's clothing, when worse comes to worse and the Christians are being persecuted out here, you know where those ministers are going to go? Right into there. That's where they're going to go. They're going to run to the government for the protection of the government. Because they're part of the thing. Jason then slaughtered his fellow citizens without mercy, not realizing that triumph over one's own kindred was the greatest failure, but imagining that he was winning a victory over his enemies, not his fellow countrymen. It's like David and Saul all over again. Saul wasn't God's enemy. Saul was his brother. He should have known that. He didn't know that. Even so, this is a Jew killing other Jews. He really is working for Antiochus, even though I think he's working against him. Even so, he did not gain control of the government, but in the end received only disgrace for his treachery, and once again took refuge in the country of the Ammonites. At length he met a miserable end, called to account before Aretas, king of the Arabs. He fled from city to city, hunted by all men, hated as a transgressor of the laws, abhorred as the butcher of his country and his countrymen. After being driven into Egypt, he crossed the sea to the Spartans, among whom he hoped to find protection because of his relations with them. There, he who had exiled so many from their country perished in exile, and he who had cast out so many to be unburied went unmourned himself, with no funeral of any kind or any place in the tomb of his ancestors. When these happenings were reported to the king, he thought that Judea was in revolt. Now, Antiochus hears this Jew came down and caused a civil war and started killing other Jews. So they finally kicked him out, and he ended up with an ignominious death. And so Antiochus says, Judea is in revolt against me. He's living in Syria. I guess at this time he was still in Egypt because he had gone down to conquer Egypt. So we're talking about the same story now, that Antiochus had gone down to Egypt, and now he's going to come back up again and conquer it. And so it says, raging like a wild animal, he took Jerusalem by storm. He ordered his soldiers to cut down without mercy those whom they met and to slay those who took refuge in their houses. Boy, how harsh can you be? Not only does he say, just kill everybody in the street, he also says, kill people who flee for refuge into their homes. This is just indiscriminate bloodshed. This is heinous and wicked. There was a massacre of young and old, a killing of women, children, a slaughter of virgins and infants. In the space of 3 days, 80,000 were lost, 40,000 meeting a violent death, and the same number being sold into slavery. Not satisfied with this, the king dared to enter the holiest temple in the world. Menelaus, the traitor, both to the laws and this country, served as a guide. Boy, I can see that happening. So that these wicked men, these persecutors of Christians, here's these false ministers, they just let them right into the church. Just come on right in. You want to interview me? I'll give you an interview. You know, come on in, we'll show you around and show you what our buildings are, and this is what we do and this is what we don't do, and just come on in. Look at this guy, has just his blood, there's still blood on his sword blade from your own Christians, and then they let him right into the church. Something is wrong somewhere. It says, Menelaus served as a guide. He laid his impure hands on the sacred vessels and gathered up with profane hands the votive offerings made by other kings for the advancement, glory, and honor of the place. Now that means kings of other foreign nations often gave gifts to other kings. Did you know that? It was common in those Old Testament times for, take the king of Spain, for example. He wouldn't have any compunction against giving a big offering of money to all the nations. He'd give it to the government of Syria, to the government of Israel, the government of France, to the government of so-and-so. Very common. Including offerings to their gods. It's just a political thing to him. It doesn't have any real religious significance. And so this is saying that the Israeli temple had offering money that other kings had given to the God of Israel, just as a political nicety, you know. And our president does this. I'm sure you're aware of this. Whenever these top officials meet together, like Gorbachev, Reagan always gives him presents, and Gorbachev always gives him presents. Now, these are personal things, man to man. Sometimes they'll give a present to their government, too. But, you know, like he'll give him, Reagan will give Gorbachev 12 Arabian horses or something like that. Or maybe an American automobile. These things come out in the press later. Sometimes they give him a small token gift, like a crystal bowl or something, you know, that's real expensive. But other times they give him expensive things. You know who had the biggest collection of American cars? Brezhnev. He did. Leonid Brezhnev. Yeah, he had something like 25 American cars. And so there's not really this equality. Communism has not been reached in communist lands, that's for sure. Yeah, they're the bourgeois. They're the ultra bourgeois. They're more bourgeois than you and me.
That's right.
How many of you have 25 cars? Anybody? You little bore? You have 4 cars? Woo! Jim. Anybody have more than 4?
We have
someone
living with us.
Oh. Oh. Debbie Irwin, my friend, there were 4 kids in their family, and so she said that their house in Kansas looked like a used car lot because her dad had 2 cars and a truck and her mom had a car and each of the kids had their own car. So that's 8 cars in their family. I think that would look really funny to me. Okay. So, let's see. Let me find where I am here. So he laid his impure hands on the sacred vessels. He gathered up the votive offerings made by other kings. So what he's doing is he's stealing temple money that belonged to Yahweh. Puffed up in spirit. And see, I can see that happening too. These Antichrist men come right into the churches and they take the offering money and just say, oh, here, we'll just take this. Boy, I'll tell you, that means something to God. You know? Christians kind of have a superstitious view, but it's a good view, and in a way, it really is a true view, but they view it kind of superstitiously. And that's this. They would never take a $20 bill out of the offering bag. Huh? Is that true? I mean, the bag is being passed down. Christians are even afraid to look in the bag. Huh? It's kind of like, I'm not going to look in the bag, I just pass the bag on, you know. It's kind of like, that thing is holy, and you just leave it alone. And it is, because that money belongs to God. And so you would never reach in and steal some of that money. These guys don't have any problem with that at all. May I also say, neither do these ministers who make salaries of well over $1 million a year. I wonder about that. Okay. Puffed up in spirit, Antiochus did not realize that it was because of the sins of the city's inhabitants that the Lord was angry for a little while and hence disregarded the holy place. Puffed up in spirit. Can you see that parallel with the Antichrist? The scripture teaches that the Antichrist will exalt himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped. Daniel says he'll magnify himself. He's lifting himself up. If they had not become entangled in so many sins, this man, like Heliodorus, who was sent by Seleucus to inspect the treasury, would have been flogged and turned back from his presumptuous action as soon as he approached. The Lord, however, had not chosen the people for the sake of the place, but the place for the sake of the people. Therefore, the place itself shared in the people's misfortunes. Antiochus carried off 1,800 talents from the temple and hurried back to Antioch in his arrogance. Now, that's Syrian Antioch. Okay? Let's see. This is, here it is here. Syrian Antioch. There's also a Pisidian Antioch. I guess it isn't on this map. We would need, this is an Old Testament map. We get a New Testament map. Let's see. Here is Pisidian Antioch. You see that? Here's the other Antioch. There's 2 Antiochs here and here. This is the Syrian one where Antiochus Epiphanes lived. That was his capital. in his arrogance, he planned to make the land navigable and the sea passable on foot. So carried away was he with pride. Boy, you have to be pretty proud to do that. You know, with our even with our technology, we could not make the sea passable on foot. Not like to connect continents or something. There's no way you could build a bridge from here to Japan, for example, or from here to Hawaii. I suppose you could argue you could build it, but the seas would destroy it, for sure. You'd have to have a floating bridge, but you know, there's 90-foot seas with 120-knot winds out there at times. It would just get destroyed. Even if they could build it, nobody would drive on it, that's for sure. You know, and then to dig a series of canals to make the land navigable, boy, that would be such a job. This guy was arrogant. People have been arrogant in modern times in this manner. I remember in the 1970s, Debbie Stutzman told me that she knew of plans Kuwait had to build a dome over the entire country. The first domed country in the world. Because of the sunlight. It's too hot. And they had these billions of dollars in oil money pouring in. So they had enough money. It was just whether it was technologically feasible to build a dome over the entire country. Yeah, air condition it. Have a domed air conditioned country. What? Not anymore.
No, Pennzoil.
Yeah, Pennzoil now. Okay, we'll take a 5-minute break.